Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Save big money on your outdoor project now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth, so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP, lawn and garden, and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today and view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals.
Save big money at Menards.
It's the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, joined as always by the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Ross Baraki. What's going on, dude?
Hey, man. I'm here. Let's do it.
He's here. He's back. We gave him a week off, some respite, and now he's back. We're talking about medical stuff. This is episode 180. We're talking about sleep apnea. This pairs with the article recently published on the website, so we link that in the description below. This is not just a recapitulation of the article. We've got some extra nuance, some extra information, some extra color commentary. That's why I'm here. Please continue to listen. I mean, or don't. You know, I won't know. All I know is the downloads, right?
Like, yeah. If people want to go read the article instead, I'll be perfectly satisfied with that. We're giving them multiple avenues for learning. That's fine by me.
That's right. However you want to feed your brain hole. All right. First up, some announcements. We are back live in the flesh for a learning opportunity. We got a two-day live seminar in Los Angeles in November. So Dr. Baraki, you'll be there. I'll be there. Leah, Tom will both be there. We're probably going to get Alan down. That would be great. Also, just as an aside, do you think that Alan had the most luxurious beard out of all World's Strongest Man competitors and support staff? Because I think for my money, that easily the best.
I'll take your word for it. I was can't say I was following the beard competition for
Strongest Man. Yeah, look, I already know that they're freaky strong. I'm just there for the beard game. And Alan has a very regal beard, looked very lubricious as well. And if you don't know what lubricious means, you should check out the latest post on the Barbell Medicine main account. We do a physics analysis of how beard hair in the bar path may, you know, contribute to some resistance, but not as much as skin. In any case, also, Austin has been killing it. We tried to record this before, and I really wanted people to understand. You are now a four-time recipient of this is an academic award for your teaching skills. This is from residents. They vote on like their favorite or the best. Is it the same? Is there like a favorite attending, and then this is like the best, or is it the same award?
Yeah, I don't know what the question prompt is to them, if it's about teaching skill or a popularity contest, but that they're at the academic internal medicine program that I work and teach at. I got the teaching award among medical students for I think the fourth year in a row, and then the overall residency teacher of the year award from the residents, which was a cool thing. The first time I've won that one, so I was pleased with that.
I only have two words. And still, like, it's like every time you win, you're like, and still. Nice. All right. Congratulations. My accolades are, you know, paltry by comparison, but I did there was an entrepreneurship capstone that I spoke at for Lawrence University. And that was fun. Just get nice. Into. Yeah, I'm always it's routine for me to talk about exercise, health, medicine, primary care, preventative med, that sort of stuff. It's just, you know, I feel like it's part of my DNA at this point, whereas the business side, I do this every day, but it's not, I don't know, I just feel different about
it. Were you speaking to people who are generally in the business scene who, like, you might be like, are they judging me?
Yeah, right. I'm sure either way, right? Yeah. But they're entering the business scene. I think most of them are trying to get into some sort of entrepreneurial gig afterwards. Yeah. And I'm like, I mean, look, if you're trying to get in the health and fitness space, I can help you out, but you know, other stuff.
Also, I've just been winging it for a while, so
100%, yeah, 100%. I got the MBA to make myself feel better, not to. Anyway, all right. Without wasting too much time, let's talk about sleep apnea. That's today's topic. Before we get any further, Austin, let's just give the listeners at home a definition of what is obstructive sleep apnea.
Yeah. So the term can sound scary and complicated and not be super clear. And so it is worth defining some things. In general, normal breathing, there's a lot actually of parts and pieces that go into normal breathing. And ultimately, the goal of breathing in and out is gas exchange. We want to bring oxygen in and to allow carbon dioxide from, you know, the byproduct of metabolism in our body to be exhaled out. And that requires a whole bunch of things to be in play. One that is really pertinent for this discussion is we need the actual airways, the tubes, what people commonly refer to as their windpipe, to be open. And that's what will allow that airflow and gas exchange to go in and out. And that is something that typically is the case when we are awake during the day. However, when people are asleep at night, there are a variety of factors that can contribute to either partial or complete kind of collapse of the airway, the windpipe, to simplify a little bit. And that can lead to complications because obviously gas exchange, breathing in, breathing out is really important for all aspects of our physiology. And so when that is impaired and the gas exchange does not happen as it is supposed to, there are a whole host of downstream consequences that we will get to later. And so ultimately, that's a long-winded way of saying obstructive sleep apnea describes a breathing disorder that happens during sleep that leads to repeated partial or complete kind of blockages, collapse, obstruction of the airway. And that can be graded on a spectrum of severity. It could be really mild, where it might happen really intermittently, occasionally, not very often, or all the way up to severe, where it's like happening near continuously, many, many, many times, even per minute for people. And that can have increasing consequences long term.
Yeah. And so just to be clear, this is obstructive sleep apnea. There are other types of sleep apnea. The most common other one, which is thankfully relatively rare, is central sleep apnea, where people are just not getting the signal to their diaphragm to like, hey, contract, you know, let the
get more some of a brain disorder than anything else. Yeah.
Yes. The pipes are fine. Brain itself not doing its thing. So we're strictly talking about obstructive sleep apnea. And the reason why we're talking about it, because this is very, very common. And in addition to being very, very common, it is undertreated and under diagnosed prior to that. So in North America alone, approximately 15 to 30% of males have obstructive sleep apnea, 10 to 15% in females. And that's basically when we're saying that about for every hour you sleep, that you're not breathing well enough five times or more. So that's called the apnea hypopnea index. Basically, it's a fancy way of saying you are not breathing at a rate, getting enough oxygen into the blood to maintain normal oxygen levels. And so if that happens five or more times per hour, well, we would diagnose you with sleep apnea. So normally people will do this, you know, once, twice, three times a lady or less. But if it gets over five, yeah, we're like, this is sleep apnea. And you can get different prevalences based on different definitions, but that's kind of the definition we're running with. Globally, people who have this desaturation or lowered oxygen concentration in the blood significant to cause negative side effects that we see from obstructive sleep apnea, this is prevalent in like 936 million people worldwide. That's a lot. That's a lot, people.
A lot of people. Yeah.
That's a lot. So that's why we're talking about it. And again, there are some there's a tie-in here to people who are into resistance training, in addition to people who are just after they're trying to live their best life, as the kids say. The prevalence does appear to be increasing, and this is likely related to the increasing rates of obesity, but also the increased detection rate of obstructive sleep apnea itself. Now that we know it's a thing, more people are looking for it, we can test for it. And so both of those things are probably contributing to the increased prevalence. But from 1990 to 2010, we saw the rate increase from 11 to 15% of adult males with obstructive sleep apnea, and then from 4 to 5%. And it's maybe close to double that now. So again, both the obesity, the increase in obesity, and then the increased detection rate probably contributing to the increased prevalence. And that's worldwide. In the United States, it's going up too, obviously. The interesting thing here is that this also parallels with people who are sleeping less than 8 hours per night. Like there's just this increase in prevalence in obesity. There's an increase in prevalence in sleep apnea and an increase in prevalence in people who are not sleeping very well. Close to 30% of people in the workforce are sleeping less than 6 hours per day, which
yeah, and that ties into a podcast we've done previously where we talked about the effects of sleep restriction on like appetite, hunger, satiety and like spontaneous calorie intake. So it's a complicated, like, you know, process that's kind of pushing in both directions. In other words, the obesity may be impairing sleep quality and the restfulness of people's sleep and how they feel and function during the day. And then, you know, at the same time, the sleep issues can contribute to increases in appetite, increased calorie intake, you know, spontaneously, not that people are volitionally choosing, you know, that as a result. It's just kind of the biological processes that are happening that then perpetuate the obesity, and it becomes this kind of nasty cycle. So it's definitely something that we look out for pretty aggressively and check for and treat pretty commonly.
Yeah. That said, there's a research study that looked at 44 different practices, medical practices. Only 20% of patients with sleep-related symptoms who regularly see their primary care physician actually reported these symptoms to the clinician. So the clinician has to have some, you know, suspicion, or at least have this as part of their algorithm. They're like asking about this stuff because, again, due to the prevalence, we would expect this to be happening regularly in clinical practice, and certainly in some practices it does, but it's still underdiagnosed and undertreated.
I guarantee
we get, you know, for each episode we're getting, you know, 100,000 downloads or something like that. And just percentage wise, if I was guessing, I would say that of the people who are listening, you know, yeah, somewhere between 10 to 20% of them are going to have sleep apnea, and probably less than half of them have, you know, actually been screened for and then subsequently treated for it. So if you're listening to this and you're like tired, please continue to listen because this may pertain to you.
Yeah. And to that, your comment on that study, I also wonder, you know, what proportion of the clinicians, the doctors or whoever we're seeing these patients ask about sleep quality, restfulness, you know, in general to assess that with their patients. I know that's a standard question that I'll ask everybody. And it becomes even more important if I see, you know, things that may be complications from sleep apnea. So if I have somebody whose blood pressure is high, then that jumps way up my list of things to look into and ask about. It kind of triggers a lot of other particular questions for me. Things like, you know, their restfulness of their sleep and alcohol use and other medications and things like that. So I think that if you're a patient and you're experiencing these things, then bringing them up is important. And hopefully if you're a clinician and you're listening to this, then you're asking your people about your patients about their sleep quality and how they feel and how they're functioning during the day.
Yep. 10 out of 10, agree. So speaking of things that you look for or may see that otherwise help you kind of like hone in on asking the questions or screening somebody, what are the risk factors for sleep apnea?
Yeah, there are a bunch of risk factors that are pretty well established at this point. So neck circumference is a commonly cited one. In men, a neck circumference of 17 inches or 43 centimeters or greater. And then in women, 16 inches or 40.5 centimeters or greater. And that's thought to be related to the amount of, again, tissues around the throat, the neck, the airway itself. And the more of that tissue there is present, you know, it's if I had to guess, as with most things, it's probably more complicated than like just purely a little mechanical pressure on the airway. But that's, you know, one of the simpler kind of explanations given for that as a risk factor. But definitely any other things that are affecting the respiratory tract. So things that can impair smooth airflow, for example, deviated septums are pretty pretty common. And that's a fancy way of talking about the little tissue that's in between your two nostrils. And if that is shifted over to one side or the other, that can mess with smooth airflow, and that can contribute to snoring. And that can also be related to sleep apnea. And then other kinds of facial structures. So if people have really short jaws, meaning front to back, like their jaws, relatively speaking, pulled back, really large tongue, really long, large tonsils, these are all things that can also block the airway, particularly when people are asleep. And, you know, you're not really paying attention to that. Things can get kind of loose and floppy in the back of your throat and contribute to that airway kind of becoming transiently or episodically blocked and impairing gas exchange and breathing. On top of that, there are tons of other ones. Again, we've already mentioned how obesity contributes, and at least part of that mechanism is going to be through the increased tissue around the airway and the neck, but also probably contributes in a bunch of other ways. Some we know, some we probably haven't even recognized yet. Age and sex are also viewed as risk factors here. So increasing prevalence starting from middle age and kind of on from there, and men are typically at higher risk from women. And this is also thought to be related to some of the changes that can happen to tissue structure, integrity, things like that over time, which raises some interesting questions that we may get into about, you know, if people perform resistance training, does that have any impact on the tissue, you know, structure, integrity, quote unquote, quality compared to those who don't? But we can hypothesize about that later, because we certainly see plenty of people who strength train who have it, including both of us. So perhaps not. People with high blood pressure, the physiology here is pretty complicated, and so I will spare the listeners that. But high blood pressure is something that can be a consequence of sleep apnea. So when I see it, I don't view it as necessarily as something that's causing the sleep apnea, but kind of more the other way around. It's more of a sign of the underlying condition. And so that kind of triggers my thought process. As with most things, a family history, a genetic predisposition, and those are usually via numerous mechanisms. Similarly, how there's a family history, there's genetic predispositions to obesity and to any number of other things. And then finally, drugs and medications. And this is a really common one. The biggest one that I investigate in this situation is alcohol use. But really, any kind of sedative type or sedating type medication that could be pain medicines, opioids, sleep aids of any kind, pain, you know, certain kinds of pain medicines, quote unquote, muscle relaxers that aren't really muscle relaxers, that kind of tranquilize people at night, things like that, that can obviously further impair people's ability to maintain their airways open. And then additionally, if their airway does kind of get collapsed or blocked during an apneic or a hypopneic episode where they're not breathing as much, the sedation of those, the drug or the medication or the alcohol or whatever it is, can also limit or impair kind of like your brain's ability to appropriately respond, react to that, and like get you awake and breathing again. And so there's multiple consequences of those kind of things. And so those alcohol and opioids and pain medicines and all these other kind of medicines are things that I commonly ask about when I'm evaluating somebody in this situation.
Yeah. When we were talking about, I remember during residency, we were kind of talking about some of the mechanisms by which alcohol and sleeping meds and sleep aids, like you mentioned, particularly ones with antihistamines. So it's like it puts you to sleep, right? And it messes with your sleep architecture, thing one, right? So your progression to deep sleep, that's kind of jacked up. So already you're like, not getting as high quality of sleep as I'd want, even if I'm sleeping more or having an easier time to sleep. But in addition to that, your likelihood of having apneic episodes goes up too. So maybe if you were borderline before, now you're actually, you know, a night of fitful rest. And so, yeah, a lot of times people will respond, you know, in the morning, they're like, I didn't sleep that well, even though I slept like a long time. And it's like, well, some of that may be related to this, but again, we wouldn't run or reduce down that experience to just like, you had some apneas. So here's the question. Do you know how big your neck is? Been fitted recently?
I think it's actually just under 17, but I have not measured it in a while.
Yeah. I'm sporting that 17 and a half inch, you know, wide body neck. That's the upgraded option.
Was that when you were weighing more like 205, 210, or I think you're a little lighter now? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I haven't measured.
Your PR neck circumference was.
Yeah. PR neck circumference is just north of 17.5. Yeah. Okay. I was like, put the big one on there. But So interestingly, you know, because people are going to listen to this and they're like, well, so if my neck gets bigger, does that put me at higher risk? And so there's some actually interesting data on this. There was a study that they at a national level powerlifting meet, they recruited 74 different athletes, 51 were men, 23 were women, recorded their anthropometry and their strength performance. And basically they broke them down into two different groups that were, they called weaker, which I don't know if the people identified after the study, they were like, wait, who you call a weak man? Those individuals had a Wilkes score of less than 370. And then those who were stronger with a Wilkes score of greater than 370. Now for comparative purposes, that Wilkes score is fine. But I think as you get further along in a powerlifting career, as you get more and more advanced, 370 is, I mean, both of our Wilkes scores are right at 500 or just above. And so I think this, you know, the trend of this data makes it more interesting than the data itself. So in any case, the men who had Wilkes scores higher than 370, and if you're not a powerlifter, what the Wilkes score basically assesses is how much weight you lifted total between your best squat, bench, and deadlift and your body weight. So a higher Wilkes score is better. The stronger men who had a Wilkes score of greater than 370 had an average neck circumference of 16 and a half inches. And then the stronger women had an average neck circumference of 14.3 inches. Now the cut points were 17 and 16. And so within that, and we add another layer here, that the average BMI of powerlifters, this was at another national level competition, the average BMI was 27.4 for the men that they studied there. And you start thinking like, does powerlifting or that sort of training put me at higher risk of obstructive sleep apnea? Or is this just something that we're seeing that people with those body types, with the propensity to gain a bunch of upper body mass, you know, yeah, those folks are going to have higher risk of obstructive sleep apnea. What do you think on that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that this has been otherwise really rigorously studied in direct fashion with this kind of athletic population that we work with. If I had to guess, I would say, yeah, I think they probably do have a higher risk of sleep apnea.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen it. There's a study I know on American football players and a study on rugby players. And there may be another one. I think it's on wrestling, but don't hold me to that. And yeah, there's some general trend, but that's people that are carrying more muscle mass. They also tend to have higher BMIs, and they also, and if you're in that population, it's likely that your neck circumference is going to be increased too. So you would imagine that sports that select for people with high amounts of lean body mass, particularly high amounts of upper body lean body mass, I mean, yeah, that's gonna be a risk factor. And so I think, you know, you and I both have sleep apnea, wear it like a badge of honor. but if you were thinking about what are some of the risks or potential downsides to getting as jacked as possible, you're like, I mean, sleep apnea, it's not great. And the mask isn't like that's not a selling point as a single guy.
Yeah, for me, I don't actually know how much of it is the training, muscle gain, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I've had a deviated septum since I was like in high school. And I think that may be a bigger contributor, honestly, because I still don't cross that like technique. You know, of course, it is a somewhat arbitrary like line where that 17 is. But as far as I know, I've not been above it. And so there may be other things going on for me. But certainly, you know, it's something that can happen and is identifiable and is treatable. And so if you want to train and get big and strong and you feel tired and are worried that you may have this, then get after it. So
yeah, it's just interesting. I'll be curious to see if more people investigate this, just because you may not, as a clinician, for example, you may not otherwise have a high like clinical suspicion of an individual who's relatively lean, otherwise healthy and young, having sleep apnea, unless they come in after having listened to this podcast. They're like, look, I'm tired during the day, my neck is big, I took the stop bang screening tool, which we'll talk about here in a second, and I'm at high risk. Please evaluate me for sleep apnea. You would have to have a really high clinical suspicion, which I imagine you do, but some of that is like your own personal experience.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So we talked about what sleep apnea is, what are the risk factors for it, but now why is this even important though? Okay. Yeah. I know, Dr. Baraki, we got to breathe to like live. Okay. But does this actually cause disease, or is the sleep apnea the disease itself? What's the deal?
Yeah, so the issue with these blockages in the airway and gas exchange and oxygenation leads to a decrease in oxygen in the blood. And that leads to a cascade of consequences, one of which is obviously a survival mechanism. Our brain can detect this, and it wakes us up to get us breathing again. And so some people are like, yeah, I don't wake up that I know of during the night, so I don't have this. But actually, that's not it. It wakes you up just enough to get breathing again, but not necessarily enough to come to full consciousness. And so people can be waking up many, many, many times per minute throughout a whole night, and they might never know it. And then they wake up and they feel terrible during the day. So typically one common feature is what's called excessive daytime sleepiness, or just, you know, being tired, disproportionate to perhaps the amount that you might expect for the amount of time that you spent in bed or the amount you slept. Morning headaches are another common feature of this. All of these things can contribute to impairments in memory, difficulty concentrating, attentional issues, which itself brings its own risks and dangers, like increasing risks of being involved in car crashes and things like that. That's an established thing, which is concerning. There are a bunch of other endocrine or hormone related consequences of this as well. So it can be, we see it in individuals with low testosterone. Unfortunately, people who have low testosterone are not often evaluated for sleep apnea, and many places just put them on testosterone, which is the incorrect treatment for somebody in that situation.
Just up the dose. That's what you got to do.
Not the correct practice, but some people just want to be on test, so they do that anyway. That's the wrong move. And then a bunch of other cardiovascular complications, so issues affecting the heart, high blood pressure, which itself can affect the heart and many other organs, increasing risk of stroke. It can contribute to abnormal heart rhythms, like atrial fibrillation, which itself can also increase risk of stroke, as well as other heart-related complications. High blood pressure in the lungs, as well as in the rest of the body, has associations with diabetes. Overall, just increase in risk of premature death. So there are lots of complications, and this has even been an incomplete list, but plenty of things that we see. I mean, I see effectively all of these things every day in practice, and a substantial portion of the time, even when somebody might tell me, yes, I already know that I have sleep apnea. Okay, are you treated for it? And they're like, no.
No.
It's like, yep. Okay, we should work on that.
Yep. Yeah. I tend to think about like the underlying mechanism like, as far as we know, going into two different like categories, two different like umbrella categories, one being basically poor sleep quality because you're getting all these micro arousals, which also, by the way, would be a terrible nickname for somebody. Oh, micro arousal is here. It's like, what the, come on, man. So you're either having poor sleep quality is one. And the other one is the sympathetic nervous system activity. So the poor sleep quality drives all sorts of stuff. Like you said, the excessive daytime sleepiness, and that can have knock-on effects, altering how full you feel from a meal, your appetite, and what you crave. All of those things change because of you weren't sleeping very well. So there can be an increased risk then of weight gain and developing obesity, dyslipidemia or cholesterol problems, as it's commonly referred to, metabolic syndrome, type 2 diabetes, etc. Also, because of the disturbed sleep, you're not getting that normal circadian rhythm, that restful sleep, and sort of how that coincides with the light-dark cycle. So you can have endocrine problems because, again, you're not sleeping very well. You can have poor ability to focus, cognitive function, altered mood. I mean, so any one of those, like, you know, spinoffs, you can, yeah, you see an increased risk of depression, for example, increased risk of cognitive impairment. Sure. The sympathetic nervous system activity is that that's a reflexive sort of way that your brain gets your body to wake up so that you can breathe. And so we're like, cool, my brain's taking care of this, no problem, right? Well, the issue is that when you're sleeping, the sympathetic nervous system, which is the fight or flight kind of arm of your autonomic nervous system, the other one being the parasympathetic nervous system, the rest and digest arm, the sympathetic nervous system is not supposed to be that active because, again, you're literally resting, right? So sympathetic nervous system is supposed to be like pretty low. And because you're getting all these like spurts of norepinephrine and epinephrine, which are the kind of neurotransmitters that the sympathetic nervous system uses, that's causing your blood vessels to constrict, for example. And that's one of the mechanisms by which high blood pressure can result from obstructive sleep apnea. But this persistent, like over, you know, hyper-reflexive activity of the sympathetic nervous system, that's also associated with the rest of the stuff: atrial fibrillation, peripheral artery disease, pulmonary hypertension, heart failure, all this other sort of stuff. Like your blood pressure is supposed to go down overnight.
Yeah. I think the athletes and the lifters in the audience will understand if we say sympathetic nervous system activity is what is maxed out when you are about to pull your third deadlift for the win or something like that.
Or go
for a PR. That is not supposed to be the internal state that your body and nervous system are in while you are in deep sleep.
Yeah. You know, it's funny
as that.
If all these people talk about adrenal fatigue, right, which is like this made up thing, unless you actually have like physical
damage,
you have Kahn syndrome, you have adrenal insufficiency, you have some other sort of deal. If they just focused on sleep apnea, as far as like that's their you know, big thing that they're targeting, like, we don't want this hyper-reflexive overactivity of the sympathetic nervous system, I'd be fine with it. I'd just leave them alone. I'd be like, this is fine. But they don't. So yeah, basically you're turned up, you're on pre-workout 24/7, which sounds awesome, but not great. So yeah, I am unsatisfied with the underlying pathophysiology. I want to learn more. I want to know more, but this has not been fleshed out all the way. So those two like umbrella things, poor sleep quality and the sympathetic nervous system overactivity, that's kind of how I conceptualize this, but there's going to be more stuff. I just don't know them yet. And we're on a time crunch here, guys. So we just can't opine eloquently about all the potential pathophysiology. Anyway, moving on to something much more practical. We talked about what sleep apnea is. We talked about why it's a big deal, who gets it, risk factors, etc. Now, here's the thing. Should everyone be screened for this? And just for the people who haven't listened to our podcast, it's one of my favorite podcasts, by the way, our screening podcast. What is the difference between screening and diagnosis? And then who should get screened for sleep apnea?
Yeah. As you know, it's a topic that gets me unusually fired up is screening.
That's true. Yep.
Screening is the process of searching for evidence of disease or risk factors for disease in people who feel fine and have no symptoms or complaints whatsoever. And the thinking when you do something like that is that if you identify this disease process or this risk factor for disease earlier in the course of somebody's life, who, again, has no symptoms at this time, doesn't feel completely fine, then you may have ideally a cost-effective treatment that you could offer them at that time that would substantially impact the trajectory of their health course over the course of life. And so there are only very few small number of conditions that we have really good evidence that we should be searching for, even in people who feel completely fine. For example, as we talked about in recent podcast, blood pressure. Blood pressure, when it's high, typically in most people does not cause symptoms, but we also have great evidence that if we screen people who feel fine and we find high blood pressure, we have very inexpensive, safe treatments that we can offer people that will dramatically reduce their risk of having substantial health complications, stroke, heart attack, premature death. That's an excellent case for screening. On the other hand, there are lots of things that people think are useful to test, which we have talked about in that screening podcast and elsewhere, where we don't have any good evidence or we have evidence that it does not help to search for these things in people who feel fine, because either treating those things doesn't actually impact their downstream health, or we don't actually have anything to treat. We don't have a treatment for that supposed condition. And so that's the whole spiel of screening in a tiny nutshell. And you contrast that with the process of diagnosis. Diagnosis is searching for a reason or an explanation for somebody's symptoms, complaints, how they look, feel, whatever's going on when they actually have something going on, not a situation where they feel completely fine and they have no complaints. So that's kind of the main difference.
Yep. No, I like that. And to be fair, it's not like Austin is saying, look, until we have evidence that the screening thing is useful, we shouldn't test for it. It's just that probably you get more angry about the stuff we have evidence against screening for, correct, or that we don't have any adequate treatments. We're like, well, what are we doing this for?
Yeah, yeah. Why did we search for this thing if we have nothing we can do about it, right?
Yeah, but if there's no evidence, you're like, I don't know if I agree, but I don't necessarily feel strongly about it because, you know, how can you feel strongly?
I have nothing to base a strong feeling on, right?
Exactly. I am Switzerland. Okay, so as far as screening in obstructive sleep apnea goes, this isn't great because there are no studies that evaluate the effect of screening everybody for obstructive sleep apnea on outcomes, meaning like, do they have a reduced risk of high blood pressure? Do people, like people in general, have a reduced risk of high blood pressure or major adverse cardiac event or type 2 diabetes or any of the other sequelae you see that sometimes occur as a result of obstructive sleep apnea? But we do have good evidence that treatment of those with sleep apnea, with CPAP, which stands for continuous positive airway pressure, or mandibular advancement devices, which I just call an oral appliance because that sounds way better, than the acronym MAD. It's like, oh, you got my MAD? I'm like, that sounds like either a street drug or like some sort of like, I don't know. So we just use oral appliance. We have evidence that using a CPAP or the oral appliance can actually improve outcomes that we're measuring. We're either diagnosing people with obstructive sleep apnea or other like important validated metric tools, like how often they stop breathing every hour, how sleepy they are, what their blood pressure is, things like things you actually care about. And so within that, yeah, you're not going to get like a grade A recommendation from the United States Preventive Services Task Force, like you should screen everyone for sleep apnea. But they're like, yeah, but we have pretty good evidence that if you catch it, we can treat it and good stuff happens. In addition to that, the like second layer of that onion is that we, when we assess like, well, what bad things would happen here? The screening tool is effectively free. It takes very little time, and it's reasonably sensitive, meaning that it's going to catch all the people, most of the people that have it, and it's reasonably specific, meaning it's not going to catch a bunch of stuff that, you know, we don't need to further evaluate anyway. There are no real harms from this. In fact, the screening, because it's not like people are like paralyzed. Oh my gosh, I might have the sleep apnea thing. That tends to not be something that happens. The actual like side effect has to do with treatment. When people like wear the CPAP mask, for example, they might report skin irritation or rash because they're allergic to the actual device material, for example, or
just the cost and inconvenience of having the thing. I mean, honestly, yeah. It's not a trivial task to transition to using something like this. It does require a pretty substantial like alteration in your sleep habits and routine. And then what do you do if you travel and things like that? It does open up some complications from that.
Yeah. Side of it. The point is, I think people, you know, if you're listening to this, you're like, yeah, well, there's not great evidence that screening everyone for sleep apnea is, you know, a great idea, but yet you guys are kind of advocating for it. So what do? And it's like, yeah, well, we have evidence that treating the thing actually benefits people. We have a way to treat it. And the harms of screening and treatment are relatively low compared to like, everyone should get a whole body CT just to check like what's going on. Right. And it's like, probably not, because there are harms, not really good evidence that that's going to do anything useful, and, you know, all sorts of stuff.
And I think that, you know, the part of the screening tool that we'll talk about in a minute has a little bit of like built-in aspects that kind of narrows the population down that we're looking for. In other words, like I'm not, if somebody that I'm seeing tells me, yeah, I feel great during the day and I don't have high blood pressure and I feel fine, then I'm not really typically chasing that much further. It's sure. Usually in people who tell me I'm tired or they have, you know, high blood pressure that I can't really explain in another way, or like I get headaches in the morning, or, you know, I don't feel well rested, and then I'll take it further from there. So it's kind of typically more of a diagnostic angle, but do I think, yeah, in the screening tool, one of the questions that we'll get to is like, do you feel tired, fatigued, or sleepy during the day? And if they say no, then we're like, okay, kinda done.
Yeah. You know, so. Yeah. The only time you may go further is if they had like resistant hypertension, high blood pressure.
Blood pressure stuff.
Yeah, tried to treat it and it's like not really responding. You're like,
yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Maybe just used to feeling like crap.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's again, in the last part of the screening thing, the reason why we're probably advocating for maybe a more aggressive screen, particularly for people who do feel tired or you know, sleepy during the day, it's that this is wildly underdiagnosed. So in population surveys, from the American Heart Association's guidelines on sleep apnea screening, 86 to 95% of individuals found in population surveys that have clinically significant obstructive sleep apnea report no prior sleep apnea diagnosis. It's not like they're just out there living like, yeah, I got sleep apnea, but I'm not going to do it. That most people didn't even know. And it's like, man, how often are people going to be able to see their physician, right? So you kind of worry about that follow-up. This can cause like serious problems. And we have good ways to treat it. So like, let's do the damn thing. Anyway, all right, moving on. What is a screening tool? I love it. I love the name. Austin, take people through this, the screening tool that we like.
Yeah, there are a few. The one that we use most commonly is called the Stop Bang questionnaire. And each letter in that tool stands for one of the questions. And so the first question is, do you snore loudly? And that's louder than talking or loud enough to hear behind a closed door. I ask this, you know, when I'm going down this kind of pathway with patients, and a lot of times they say, no, I don't snore, but, you know, maybe they sleep alone and nobody would know. Or maybe if they sleep with a bed partner, that person also snores, or maybe is not able to detect it. And so if I find this question to be more useful when this person or their partner says, yes, they snore. Whereas if they say no, I often don't put as much stock in that, just because it's harder for people to know for sure that they don't. The next question is, do you feel tired, sleepy, or fatigued during the day? Super useful question for this diagnosis and part of this evaluation. The next one is, has anyone told you that you stop breathing at night? Sometimes people will have witnessed somebody completely stop breathing for a few seconds, 10 seconds, something like that. And then they might actually gasp for air after that as they kind of, again, get that micro arousal that you talked about and then catch back up again. And that, if I hear somebody say that, then I am actually quite confident that they probably have sleep apnea. This is like probably the most specific of the questions in here for the actual diagnosis, because it's like, yes, somebody witnessed me having sleep apnea. I probably have sleep apnea. Next is, do you have or are you treated for high blood pressure? We've mentioned this a few times now, how this condition, probably complicated set of reasons, including the sympathetic nervous system activation and other things, can lead to high blood pressure. And so this, again, is a feature that will immediately get my attention to ask about sleep in people and whether they could have sleep apnea. The last few questions, BANG, here, is your body mass index greater than 35? And so that's the typical BMI calculator that everybody would be familiar with, or is easy enough to Google and put your own numbers in and see if it's greater than 35. That gets at the question of the relationship between obesity, all this extra tissue around the neck, et cetera, and sleep apnea. Is your age greater than 50? Obviously, we mentioned that middle age is where the risk really starts to go up, and this increases beyond that point. Although I will say I have seen tons of people below 50 with this. And so how much, you know, if they're below 50, I would not say that this like substantially decreases my suspicion that somebody might have sleep apnea if they tell me the other things that kind of smell like it, like I'm tired, sleepy during the day, morning headaches, things like that. The next question is your neck circumference over the cutoffs that we mentioned earlier? which is usually a little bit of a tougher one because most people have not measured their own neck circumference and maybe they're not able to immediately do it on the spot. So I often have to ask them to do that if I'm doing a telemedicine consultation or something like that. And then the last question is male versus female. We mentioned that male have higher risk in general. And so then there's a scoring system for this. And we'll have a link to this questionnaire and people can click it and take the quiz if they want to. And it'll basically spit out a score. And then there are kind of, you can stratify your interpretation of the score between low risk for sleep apnea, intermediate risk for sleep apnea, high risk for sleep apnea, based on the ultimate kind of number of yes answers or like high risk answers that you provide. And all of this is also outlined in the article on the website.
Yeah. Did you actually take the stop bang before you were evaluated?
No, because I felt bad and my wife told me that I snored and that I can't remember if she told me that I stopped breathing or not, but that was the tiredness and the snoring was kind of enough for me to pursue that.
I got spotted by my neurology attending when I was in medical school. Instead of making eye contact like, you know, most normal, well-adjusted humans would do, he was giving me the elevator eyes, but only down to my neck. And then he looked at my face and he goes, you're tired? I'm like, every day. He's like, what's your neck? I was like, these shirts are 17 and a half. So I think he just did like my own stop bang, sent me home with a home sleep study, which is a nice lead in to how do we diagnose this? You know, there's two major options, right? The sleep lab and the at-home test. Like what goes on in a sleep lab? And then when would you use the at-home test for people?
Yeah, so going through a sleep test is a bit of a process, I will say. And obviously, we mentioned that with obstructive sleep apnea, our main concern is this issue of gas exchange and oxygen levels in the blood and things like that. And so that's obviously, again, those are going to be things that are monitored during a sleep test, your blood oxygen levels. There are going to be sensors like under your nose, for example, for like airflow in that area and a few other things. In an actual formal sleep lab, when you go in to do that, which is how I got my diagnosis, I went through that process. They actually hook you up to a number of other sensors. And that can be helpful, not just for the diagnosis of obstructive sleep apnea, but also for numerous other sleep disorders that people may be familiar with, be it like a restless legs kind of thing or narcolepsy or any number of other kind of things that can be tested more formally in a sleep lab. There are a bunch. And so this may include EEG or like electrical stickers that get put on your skull to monitor your brainwave activity. Again, the oxygen sensors, there's like a chest strap that will monitor your chest wall expansion or an abdominal, similar for the abdomen, sensors on the legs to monitor your leg movement, one under the chin as well. So there are for teeth grinding and things like that. And so there are a lot of sensors, and this can admittedly be pretty distracting and uncomfortable because most people are not used to having that. And so I hear from patients as well as my own experience going through that, it's like, yeah, I didn't feel like I slept great. But again, the people who collect the data and interpret it, they can generally tell if they had got enough quality data to provide an interpretation and a diagnosis. And so an in-lab test is, you know, technically going to be the gold standard, the best quality that you can get, as well as can help you diagnose the broadest number of things. There are downsides, of course. You have to, you know, go into a lab at night and sleep there overnight. And when I did mine, I had to go right into work the next morning from there. And that was kind of inconvenient and things like that. But there are certain situations and reasons why it would be recommended for somebody to get one done in a sleep lab. The alternative, and what I use a lot of time with telemedicine patients that I work with who may be super busy, not have access to a sleep lab, you know, easily, or any number of other reasons, in whom I have a reasonable enough suspicion that they may have sleep apnea, is something called an at-home test. And there are companies that will basically mail you a kit with a smaller number of devices that you will monitor to include your oxygen saturation and a couple other things, but it's not as elaborate as an in-lab test. And that data gets collected in the device and you mail it back and it gets interpreted and then the report gets sent to the doctor who ordered the thing. These tests can be quite effective in a patient who, you know, is suspected they may have sleep apnea. However, for people, they're imperfect tests for a variety of reasons. You're relying on the person to hook everything up right, do everything right. They have pros in that you're at home in your own environment, but there are other reasons why they may not provide as high quality of data as an in-lab test. And so as a result, if I have somebody who I'm quite worried or, you know, very concerned may have sleep apnea and I do a home sleep test and it seems to suggest that they don't, I may, if my suspicion is high enough, I might still recommend that they get an in-lab test because I may not trust that, I might be worried about a false negative or something like that. And there are other, like, you know, really high critically important, you know, people who work in critically important positions like airline pilots and other things like that, where it's like, we can absolutely not miss this diagnosis, where the more aggressive, like in-lab testing may be recommended because of the consequences or risks of a false negative kind of situation. You wouldn't want your plane crashing because somebody didn't, you know, missed a diagnosis of sleep apnea in your pilot.
Yeah. The sleep lab can be cool too with when they're doing the split sleep stuff where they will like treat you in the middle of the night and kind of like figure out what your best, settings are. Although it's less of a concern now with like the auto titrating CPAPs, but still, like if you had kind of a funky sort of setup, it'd be nice to get that done in the sleep lab.
Sure.
I had this is embarrassing. But you know, that's why we're here. I had this woman who was a patient of mine, a long time ago, and it said on her DME list that she had a CPAP. And I was like, oh, and you know, she did not tell me that she had obstructive sleep apnea during her medical history. I go, and you have sleep apnea, right? And she goes, no, I don't have that. And I was like, well, you have a CPAP. What's the deal? It's like just recreational, like oxygen use or what's, you know, whatever. So she has catarrhythmia, this like prolonged expiration, or like nighttime groaning, I think is like the common parlance, where people like breathe out or groan or at night for a long period of time, and they sometimes desaturate. But in any case, you treat it with the CPAP. And I was like, mind blown.
Yeah.
I thought I was just in a bad mood.
Yeah. Can't say I've seen that one before.
No, but I was like, I looked it up. I was like, oh, that's a parasomnia. But yeah, there are other things that you would, you know, somebody can have multiple parasomnias. That's a thing. Like they can have sleep apnea and restless legs or like, you know, other sort of things. So yeah, the sleep lab can be useful to kind of like, as you said, in a very critical setting, if you're trying to one and done, let's get this thing done, like diagnosed, sleep lab. You went to one. I've never been in one. Is it nice?
It was okay. I mean, it was just the sheer number of things that I was hooked up to. I was like, this is
ridiculous. But it's not like a call room, right?
No. It's like a bedroom.
That's what I imagine. It's like a call room. I go in there. You have PTSD. I can't sleep. I'm just like, no.
Waiting for my pager to go off.
That's what I'm saying. They actually throw a pager in the middle of the night. Actually, you're in like some sort of research setting. Yeah. Okay. So you get this diagnosis in their sleep lab or at home test or whatever. Now what? You got this diagnosis. Now you are an individual with sleep apnea. You go to meetings. How do you treat this thing?
Yeah. So there's obviously, we mentioned a whole bunch of risk factors that can increase the risk of sleep apnea. And so targeting those up front is always wise. And so the first is obesity, trying to manage that. If people can successfully lose and maintain weight loss, whether through their lifestyle means or lifestyle plus medication or lifestyle medication surgery, as we've talked about on other podcasts, significant weight loss can itself cure sleep apnea in some people. I will not say it's a guarantee in everybody. Some people who are relatively lean or are thin can still have it. But for those who have obesity and sleep apnea, weight loss can substantially improve the severity of their condition, or can make it, you know, minimal enough that it does not substantially impact their life. There are other sleep-related things that can contribute to sleep apnea or otherwise to sleep quality that can sometimes be addressed. For example, people with like really bad seasonal allergies, for example, that can cause, you know, really inflamed nasal passages and other things that can impact airflow and ability to breathe during the night. And so treating allergies, if that's an issue for a person, as aggressively as needed to get that calmed down and improve the swelling and inflammation and improve airflow. Gastroesophageal reflux, or what people commonly know as heartburn, even though it does not always have to cause actual burning or pain. But reflux conditions can also impair sleep through a variety of ways. And so if that's an issue for somebody, addressing that can also help. And then, so we're kind of working our way up from like the most conservative and lifestyle measures up towards the more specific treatments for sleep apnea. On a sleep test, sometimes they will also break down the rate that people had breathing, you know, episodes where they stopped or slowed down their breathing by body position, meaning were they on their back, were they on their side, were they on their front, et cetera. And so there are some people who, for example, they will have tons of episodes when they're lying flat on their back, and if they're on their side, they're totally fine. And so sometimes it's just simple positioning maneuvers for people may be enough if you can manage to keep them on their side. The question is how well, if you tell somebody to sleep on your side, do they actually stay on their side all night? And so then people have come up with various tricks. There are, you know, things like straps with a tennis ball on them that get wrapped around the chest that make it, you know, with the tennis ball on your backside so that it's like just uncomfortable to lay down on your back. You got a tennis ball sticking between your shoulder blades as an example, which is just like a way to make it unpleasant to sleep in the position where you stop breathing and just forces you to stay on your side. Works for some people if they, you know, if that's their situation and they don't want to use sleep apnea therapies like CPAP. And then, so beyond all the lifestyle things, the allergies, the reflux, the positioning maneuvers, if those are worthwhile or an option for a person, then the final ones that we'll mention, I'll take the PAP and then you can mention what you use for the other side. But PAP basically stands for positive airway pressure. And these are machines that deliver a typically gentle amount of pressure. And that pressure maintains at the end of your exhalation. And it makes it so that when you exhale, and the pressures in your airways are at their lowest, that little gentle back pressure that it provides is kind of just enough to keep everything open. And the way I kind of conceptualize this, or I help people understand when I'm explaining this, is to imagine when you're blowing up a balloon and, you know, let's say it takes you multiple breaths to blow up the balloon and you have to kind of like hold a little bit of pressure against the balloon while you're taking in your next breath so that the balloon doesn't like push its air all the way back into your lungs. That little gentle amount of like back pressure that you have to put against the partially inflated balloon is kind of like what's going on to keep all your airways and everything wide open, allowing for that smooth airflow during your actual breath. And so that's kind of what this machine helps to facilitate. And historically, they were called CPAPs because that stood for continuous positive airway pressure, where it was just set at one particular pressure for a given individual. And that had to be determined in a lab setting often. And that was kind of inconvenient. And people's pressure needs may vary, you know, throughout the course of a night or night to night, or if you drank a little bit more alcohol and things were a little more prone to collapsing or things like that, you may need different pressures. And so now we have more advanced machines. They're called APAPs or auto PAP machines, where they basically respond to your feedback, kind of pay attention to you, quote unquote, and will adjust the amount of pressure that is being applied throughout the night, night to night, et cetera, based on your needs. And so those can increase comfort, make it so that you don't feel like you're fighting the machine if the settings are not exactly right for you, and can, you know, make it so that they're a little bit easier to tolerate. And so that's what's used most often these days. And they're quite nice, honestly, because it's made it so that, you know, from a telemedicine standpoint, if I'm working with somebody remotely, rather than in person, if my suspicion is high, they have it, I can get them set up with a home sleep test. They can do it at home. I can set them up with an auto PAP, and that can, you know, get the settings exactly to what they need on its own. And they end up never really having to go through a detailed, you know, evaluation and titration process in a sleep lab. And that may work well for them. Of course, if they run into issues along the way, they may need to, you know, go in and get that reevaluated. But for a fair number of people, that seems to work pretty well, pretty convenient, and is much simpler than it used to be in the past. So that's the idea with PAP. What about the oral appliance that you talk about?
Yeah, there's a bunch of different types of oral appliances, and they're just what they sound like. They're things that go in your mouth. And the most common one is called a mandibular advancement device, or a MAD. It basically tries to shove your mandible, the bottom part, your jawbone, forward a little bit to keep your airway open. Those things come in all different shapes and sizes. You can get them fully custom out, like a custom kit. And those things are rather expensive. Usually insurance will cover it. Your dentist, particularly if they have an interest in sleep medicine, might be able to make that for you or hook you up with another specialist who does that, or your sleep physician definitely has a contact, somebody who could do a custom job. There's also ones that are like, we call them boil and bites. You pick them up at a pharmacy, you make them hot, and then you bite down on them. So they're kind of like customized-ish to your mouth, but that's for mandibular advancement devices. There's other ones that control the position of your tongue. So that all that they're trying to do is keep the airway open, reduce snoring. And to be fair, just to clarify, not fairness necessarily, but to clarify, primary snoring is its own thing. That's not sleep apnea. People can snore and not have sleep apnea, and people can have sleep apnea and not necessarily snore a whole bunch. So but just to be clear, the benefit of these oral appliances, and again, there are other ones as well, is for mainly for people who either will not or cannot use the CPAP or the APAP. They got it. They can't find a, you know, either the nasal pillows or the mask or some combination or what that is comfortable, and they throw it off in the middle of the night, and now they're inadequately treated, even though they know they have the diagnosis.
Yeah, that can be a tough situation, and it definitely involves some like expectation setting with people up front. If the expectation is that, oh, I'll just put this on and sleep perfectly right away, like that is not typically the way this goes. My own experience was like I got my AutoPAP and put it on, and I had a full face mask and around basically the nose and the mouth is what I was wearing. And I wore the first night for like 20 minutes, and I was like, I can't do this. And then I was like, okay, I'm motivated though. So the next night, let me see if I can beat 20 minutes. And it was like an hour. And then the next night was a little more. And then by the end of like a week or so, I was wearing it kind of throughout the night, just kind of got used to it over the course of a few nights. And that's a really common experience. And then additionally, there can be situations where the kind of mask that is used is not the best for the person, or they may not like it or tolerate it. And so there are a variety of mask options that can be discussed with the healthcare professional to see if there's one that can work better for you. Because again, like this is really worth fixing or addressing adequately if you can. And then finally, you know, if the mask is not really the issue, then it could be related to the settings of the machine or something like that. So that's kind of, there's a lot of troubleshooting that can be involved there.
Yeah. Yeah. The oral appliances can be useful. I don't want people to think like that it's a either or. Some people will like, you know, like me, for example, I have a traveling CPAP or APAP that I like take with me on the road, mainly because my oral appliance is very, very expensive. And I'm like kind of afraid. Do you remember we got robbed in Florida? Our Airbnb. Well, I only figured it out because that we got jacked because my toothbrush was on the living room floor. And then we realized that Tom's stuff was missing. But yeah, my oral appliance is gone. And I'm like, dang. So I'd rather them steal one of these like rink-a-dink, you know, travel CPAP things. But yeah, and I keep the oral appliance at home. If you have severe sleep apnea, to my knowledge, the oral appliance is not really the way to go. It just doesn't do enough. But yeah, if you have mild or moderate, you know, you may talk to your physicians, particularly if you're not really satisfied with how your ability to wear the mask and you guys have exhausted all options. And anyway,
and I have had one patient who did not do great with many of these things. And ultimately there are some surgical options. They are not things that I recommend for people all the time. And they're not really things that I have a ton of direct experience or expertise in to speak on at length, but there are surgical options that can be done basically on those soft tissues in the back of the mouth, throat, palate, et cetera. And so that's something that if you have this condition and it is not able to get adequately treated through these other means, it is something that is potentially worth at least asking or discussing about or having a consultation with a surgeon to see if it would be, you know, of benefit to you. So
like a pharyngoplasty or something, or like hyoglossal nerve stimulation.
I suspect there's a bunch of different ones based on the anatomy of the person and where their suspected issue is. But
yeah. Just for our lifter folks, because we're going to wrap this up here. You're listening to this, you're like, yeah, I'm kind of tired sometimes, but I don't always sleep as much. All right. My neck is approaching the cutoff, but you know, it's because I'm yoked. What's in it for me? Well, let me tell you, okay? If you make just a few logical leaps, you will see that sleep apnea may be inhibiting your gains. And I think I can make a pretty solid argument. So we know, for example, that sleep apnea tends to reduce the sensitivity of individuals to dietary anabolic stimuli. And we know this because the muscle protein synthesis rates decrease. That's thing one. Thing two, we know that reduced sleep and poor sleep, for example, that occurs secondary to untreated sleep apnea, okay, messes with your satiety and appetite. So you would likely become less full from a meal. You would likely overeat on energy-dense foods. You would likely increase your body fat mass, which is not something you want for the gains, okay? We know that that also compromises performance across all different things like cognitive performance, physical performance. So if you're trying to be your strongest, having your sleep under control would be great. And then finally, muscle mass itself. If you look at cross-sectional data on muscle mass and people's sleep apnea, it's no surprise that people with the highest amounts of muscle mass also have the highest incidences of sleep apnea. Why? Because this is correlated to BMI. In the general non-lifting population, people with the highest BMIs also carry the most muscle mass. Now, what we see over time when they're untreated is that the muscle mass retains the same size but gets a lot of fatty depositions in them. You're losing skeletal contractile muscle tissue, and a lot of that is the volume of the muscle is getting replaced with fat, which is not what you want when you're on the platform. So listen, if you're out there and you're like, you know, I do have some daytime fatigue, but nah, I'm otherwise okay. I got enough pre-workout to get me going. You don't want this. You don't want this smoke. And you can see if you're at moderate or high risk by just doing the screening test. We don't get any money. It's free. We don't get any money from this. ResMed isn't sponsoring this podcast. I'm just telling you that by all of these lines of evidence, reduced muscle protein synthesis, altered satiety and appetite regulation, decreased performance acutely, and then decreased contractile tissue long term, I'd want to treat this.
I have nothing to say. Agree.
This may be one place where Stan Efferding and I, we like agree. We're like, look, man, if you want to like
some other places too, but this is a pretty strong one.
Yeah. Maybe not as many as we think. Anyway, anything you want to add for this on sleep apnea stuff?
I got nothing else, man.
All right, cool. So we got the article that's linked in the description below. We got the stop bang questionnaire linked in the description below. Also linked to all of our other stuff, our other podcasts, our free app, our website, etc. So you guys know where to go. But before you go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. Again, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. I've been joined by Dr. Austin Rocky. Big shout out to him. We're off next week because it's my birthday, but then we'll be back the week after that. So until then, keep it right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.